books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a very pared down edition of Read On that I finished editing moments ago. RNIB is very proud to work with the Booker Prize Foundation to ensure that the shortlisted titles in the Booker Prize are available in accessible formats for everyone to enjoy. Former winners of the prize include many of the literary giants of the last five decades, from Iris Murdoch and Salman Rushdie to Ian McEwan and Hilary Mantel. Well, in a few days' time, or if you're listening to this on Monday, in a few hours' time, we'll know the winner of 2025. And, well, we'll definitely hear them in today's show, as I talk to all six Booker shortlisted authors. So, in the order that I interviewed them in, here's Flesh by David Saloy, is described as a propulsive, hypnotic novel about a man who is unravelled by a series of events beyond his grasp. The audio version is read by Daniel Wayman.
After a while, another car comes along the track from the opposite direction. It's a small Suzuki Jeep with Croatian plates. "Wait here," Erdern says. "Keep your eyes open." He walks towards the Jeep, which has stopped. Two men get out and they talk. They seem to be speaking English, but they talk in quiet voices and István can't hear what they're saying. He can't see them very well either in the dusky light. He just stands there, with his hands in his pockets, feeling cold. His feet, especially, feel very cold. He's wearing the wrong sort of shoes. He looks down at them, and at the half-frozen mud of the track. About a week ago, he ran into Erdern in the town. He knew him slightly from the Young Offenders Institution. Erdern seemed pleased to see him, and asked did he want to earn some money. István asked him what he meant. Erdern explained that he had to pick some stuff up in Croatia and needed someone to go with him. "Why?" István asked.
"To watch my back."
"What stuff?" István asked.
"Whatever. That's not important."
"Why do you need someone to watch your back?"
"So that I feel safe."
"Why wouldn't you feel safe?"
"I'd feel safer with someone like you with me."
"What do you mean, someone like me?"
"You know what I mean," Erdern said.
And it's true that István had made a sort of name for himself in the institution. Like everyone in there, he had had to look out for himself. There were some fights. He had an aptitude for fighting, he discovered. That's probably what Erdern was talking about. When he told István how much he would pay him, István said he would do it. And now he's here, in the cold wood, hugging himself and trying to hear what Erdern is saying to those two men about 50 metres away, in the half-darkness under the trees.
Flesh is, basically, it's the story of more or less the whole life of a Hungarian character called István. And it begins when he's 15 and living on a sort of council estate in a Hungarian town with his mother. And it follows him for decades after that. All kinds of things obviously happen to him, but I guess most notably, or the biggest sort of single aspect of his life that the book covers, is he moves to England, to London, and spends many years there. So it's a story of a Hungarian man emigrating to London, in essence, but I hope it's much more than that too.
Erdern comes back with a bag, a sort of nylon sports hold-all. He puts it in the car and then reverses along the track the way they came. "What is it?" István asks, blowing into his hands.
"Drugs."
"Whatever," Erdern mutters. He's twisted round in his seat, reversing along the track which is too narrow for him to turn in. It's nearly dark now. When they reach the main road, which is itself just a quiet, two-lane thing without any traffic, he puts the headlights on. They drive back to the town, and then to a part of it that István doesn't know very well. A few years ago, it was mostly vineyards and fields. Now there are more and more houses on the hillside. They stop at one of them, and István waits in the car while Erdern rings the doorbell. "Who lives there?" István asks him when he returns without the hold-all.
"I don't know,"
Erdogan says. He pays István his money and drives him home. They do the same thing a few more times that winter, and for a while, István has money. He mostly spends it on going out, although the town's nightlife is very limited. The main place is jungle. Sometimes he sees Erdogan there. On one such occasion, when he's drunk, Erdogan tells him that he thinks it's heroin in the bags they pick up. He says that one of the main heroin routes into Europe is through the Balkans, and that this might be part of it. After they've had a few drinks, they talk about taking one of the bags and selling the stuff themselves, if it is heroin. They never do that, though. They never even look in the bags. They're too scared of the man in the house. And also, they're satisfied with the money he pays them for delivering the stuff to him, whatever it is. It seems like a lot to them.
As we were saying before we started the recording, you were last on Read On 9 years ago with All That A Man Is. They're kind of 9 stories that the reader has to link themselves. Are there similarities between that book and Flesh, as in we're linking these little vignettes into your character's life?
Yes, I think there are. I mean, I think All That Man Is was a sort of novel disguised as a collection of stories, you might say, whereas Flesh you could describe almost as a collection of short stories disguised as a novel, because it is a novel in, you know, a traditional sense. It's about one character and follows that character across many years and in a sort of coherent story. But on the other hand, it's made of 10 chapters, which are, as you say, quite self-contained narrative units. So almost, some of them I would say almost could stand on their own as individual pieces of writing, but they are, of course, also part of the larger story. But each chapter covers only a few weeks or months of István's life and is usually separated from the chapters on either side of it by years that we don't really directly see. So yes, there is a sort of, there is a structural similarity with All That Man Is, definitely.
And István travels from Hungary to London. Is that a reverse telling of your own journey?
In a very literal sense, yes. I mean, I grew up in London and lived in Hungary for many years. So yes, I did, when I was sort of contemplating the book, I did very definitely want to write something which had both an English aspect and a Hungarian aspect, because my life at that time was kind of stretched between those two places, I guess. You know, I'd come to a point where I didn't feel 100% sort of at home or based in either place, and I wanted to somehow use that feeling in the book I was about to write, so that was definitely there. I also have relatives who made exactly the same journey as István, in the sense that they, cousins of mine, who grew up in Hungary and moved to England around the time that Hungary joined the EU in 2005, as István does.
Was the book always going to be called Flesh?
No, I mean, Flesh was actually the working title of the book, but somehow there was a sense that it would be replaced by a kind of, I guess, a more elegant or literary title at some stage when the book was finished. But when it time came to actually think of that more elegant or literary title, we couldn't. We couldn't think of anything better than Flesh. I mean, Flesh, although it was quite a sort of rough, almost sort of vulgar, slightly vulgar sounding title, which kind of made people feel slightly uneasy in a way, we decided that those were actually good things about it, and that it really spoke to something deep in the book. And there was a reason, actually, why I had used it as a working title, which I'd done without really spending much time thinking about it. It was just the word that kind of came to hand. So I think it's the best and most appropriate title for the book in the end, yeah.
Flesh is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library and available in all formats commercially, but it's available from RNIB in both audio and braille. And David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Flashlight by Susan Choi is described as a thrilling, globe-spanning novel that mines questions of memory, language, identity and family. The audio version is read by Eunice Wong.
Louisa and her father are making their way down the breakwater, each careful step on the heaved granite blocks, one step farther from shore. Her mother is not even on the shore, for example, seated smiling on the sand. Her mother is shut inside the small, almost waterfront house they are renting, most likely in bed. All summer, Louisa has played in the waves by herself, because her mother isn't well, and her father is unvaryingly dressed in a jacket and slacks. But tonight, he has finally agreed to walk the breakwater with her. She has asked every day since they first arrived. Spray from the waves sometimes lands on the rocks, and so he has carefully rolled up the cuffs of his slacks. He still wears his hard, polished shoes. In one hand, he holds a flashlight, which is not necessary. In the other hand, he holds Louisa's hand, which is also not necessary. She tolerates this out of kindness.
One thing I will always owe your mother is she taught you to swim, because swimming is important to know how to do for your safety. But when she gave you lessons, I thought it was too dangerous. I was very unfair.
I hate swimming.
They both know the opposite is true. Perhaps her father recognizes her comment for what it partly is, a declaration of loyalty to him, as well as for what it mostly is, a declaration by a 10-year-old child who is contentious by reflex.
Slashlight is a novel that is, at its core, about a very small, not particularly happy family. Louisa, who is 10 years old when we meet her, and her mother and father. Mother Anne is an American, Father Cirque is not. And his background is he's an ethnic Korean who grew up in Japan, but it's a little more complicated than even Louisa or her mother know. He's not prone to talking about himself, but he does take them back to Japan where he grew up. And the trip is a catastrophe. The exact way in which it's a catastrophe, I'm trying to kind of keep that card to my chest in order for the reader to be able to enjoy the way the book unfolds. But Louisa and her mother return to the U.S. alone. And then we follow everyone forward sort of from this moment of impact that busts the family up as they discover kind of what exactly happened to them and why.
Far over the water, far beyond where the breakwater joins with a thin spit of sand, the sunset has lost all its warmth and is only a paleness against the horizon. They'll turn back soon.
I never learned to swim,
her father reveals.
I don't believe you,
she scoffs. Everybody can swim. Though it's true he always makes a big deal when she wants to get in or even get near the water.
It's true. I grew up a poor boy. I had no YMCA.
The YMCA is disgusting. I hate going there.
Someday, you'll feel thankful to your mother. But I want you to act thankful now.
These are the last words he ever says to her. Or are they the last words that she can remember? Did he say something more? There is no one to ask.
Now, the headline I've seen a couple of times when researching this is, it's an alternate universe version of your family. How much of it is true?
This is something that I'm saying, to be honest, under direct questioning, because there is a tendency to kind of point out that there are a few autobiographical overlaps between my actual family and this very fictional family. And it is very true that a childhood trip to Japan when I was young, which did not result in catastrophe, happily, or really anything in particular, was my original impetus for writing the book because it had made such an impression on me. But it only made an impression on me. And, you know, as an adult writer, and I say that because I did scribbling as a kid too, but as an adult writer, you know, you come to recognize that you need a real story. What had happened to my family wasn't a story. We went to an overseas country. I'd never been to such a place, and so I was quite impressed. But as I began my, you know, writing career and started realizing what you need for a plot, I knew that would never do. So this book comes out of my interest in the history of the region, in some real life events in that region that did not affect my family, but that I sort of, you know, kind of in this alchemy wanted to see, like, well, what if those had affected my family? You know, what if we had been subjected to such forces? And so I think that's kind of where this idea of like a dark side or alternate universe version of my life comes from. The book strays pretty far away from my autobiography pretty quickly. And also I hope that the character of Louisa, who I make into a very difficult child, doesn't reflect me. My mother says that I was a very nice child, so I'm hoping she's right.
Of course, Japan in the 1970s would have been very different to the Japan we know today.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I think, one of the reasons I so wanted to write about that experience for so long, because it wasn't just that it was a Japan of my childhood that felt a little bit like a dream state, but also a Japan that I think is so far removed from contemporary Japan. It was really a profoundly different place. The forces of Western culture had made not very much of a dent. I remember two experiences of mine that I, you know, allude to in the book, in the way that I, you know, borrowed little bits and pieces of my childhood memory to try to lend verisimilitude to the book, was going with my father to the very first McDonald's that opened in Osaka, and kind of the mob scene of I think bemused, but also like, you know, riveted Japanese people kind of checking out, like, what was this sort of phenomenon, the American beef burger. And also in the book, I make use of a memory that I have of seeing the movie Close Encounters of the First Kind in Japan, and what a sort of spectacle this was as well, of like two cultures that really had not had a lot of interaction, kind of trying to interact with each other, you know, sort of early on. And so it does feel like a lost, you know, lost land. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to try to recreate it.
Flashlight grew from a short story into a much larger work. Did it just want to be written, or, well, what made you realize that there was a much bigger story in there?
Yeah, its process of evolution was a little bit the opposite direction from what it might seem, because it was already a book that I was really grappling with. Like, I, you know, just was kind of floundering about on the inside of this idea already, and already was trying to understand how to make it a novel. I have my characters. I sort of had the big basics of what was going to befall them, and I could not find my way in to how to tell the story to the reader. And so the short story that came out in late 2020 by the same title was a product of like those big struggles with a book that was not letting me get my arms around it at all. And so I had the thought, like, you know, well, I wonder if I can just skip ahead in the sequence of events that I'm imagining, because I was quite stuck on some of the major ones, and just, you know, write about the characters after these things have happened to them, as if they've already happened. Well, you know, not just as if they'd already happened, but assuming they'd already happened, but as if I'd already written the bits in which they'd happened. And that's what that story was really kind of an exercise in me trying to get unstuck on this much larger idea that already, as I say, was kind of defeating me. And so it wasn't wrote the short story and then thought, oh, let's make this bigger. It was more the, oh my God, this is too big. How might I make it smaller for the moment?
Flashlight by Susan Choi is available in all formats commercially, and also available in audio and braille from RNIB Talking Books. And Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
On today's show, all six of the shortlisted authors on the Booker shortlist for 2025. Next week's show will be a longer interview with the winner of the prize, but for now, next up, The Land in Winter, written by Andrew Miller, is described as a masterful page-turning examination of the minutiae of life and a dazzling chronicle of the human heart. The Land in Winter is read by Andrew Miller himself.
He was lying on a varnished wooden board, the top of a boxed-in radiator. The board was exactly as wide as his shoulders, and he knew, from painful experience, he must sit up like a man emerging from his own coffin. Roll over, and he would be on the floor. Above the radiator, a tall window was covered with thin curtains, a pattern of stripes, green, brown and red. He lifted a corner of the cloth and looked out. Deep space, the heart of night, a single small light left burning through fog above the door of the industrial therapy department. The time? He sifted it from the air, from the many small clues it gave. Presences, absences. He had owned, when he first arrived, a watch with a brown leather strap, one of his better things. He had managed to keep hold of it for 2 weeks before it was stolen. He knew who had taken it. A man who choked to death in the refectory 6 months later, inhaling a mouthful of mashed potato. The watch must have been given to the dead man's family, along with a dozen other effects from his locker. It might have puzzled them, the nice watch they didn't know he'd had. He let the curtain drop. He wondered what had woken him. There was no shouting, no sound of running feet, no alarm. The place was hushed. The room he was in, a common room, a big room with a high ceiling, was deserted. But somewhere, something had changed. Something had fallen or risen.
The Land in Winter is set in the very early 1960s. It's the sort of 1960s before it really knows it's the 1960s. More sort of Acca Bilk than Rolling Stones. And it's set in the southwest of England, in a village not so far from Bristol, perhaps. And it's two couples, youngish married couples, not very, very young, but sort of in their late 20s, early 30s. On the one side of a field, we've got the doctor and his wife. And on the other side of the field, a rather unlikely farmer and his wife. So these two couples are there at the beginning of this sort of astonishing winter. There had been nothing like it for 100 years, and we've had nothing really like it since. The sea froze for a couple of miles from the coast, and it was it's astonishing period that went on from sort of Christmas until March. And as I think quite a lot of people, there's a lot of folk memory around this time. And I get readers come and talk to me about their memories of being children, usually in this time. And it was an incredibly fierce winter that cut off lots of towns and villages, particularly in the southwest, actually, which is where the book is set, which took a lot of the worst of the weather. Some really extraordinary blizzards. So life changed very dramatically and really rather suddenly in that sort of late December of 1962.
He swung himself to sit on the board, legs dangling. He patted his hair, he still had some, and looked down the length of the room. The stiff little tables with their stiff little chairs, the foil ashtrays. On one wall, screwed to the wall and out of reach, was a painting of hot air balloons. On the opposite wall, also screwed on, also out of reach, was a photograph of the young queen in her coronation robes. Other than for his shoes, he was fully dressed. A brown, pin-striped suit with a cardigan under the jacket, the cardigan a present from his daughter, the younger one, last Christmas or the Christmas before. Red wool and warm, slightly too big, or becoming so. The older girl had stopped coming years ago. He must have worried about that once. Not anymore. Awake now, clear-headed in one of those lulls when the things they gave him had lost their force, he stood, steadied himself, and set off. In his socks, he could move almost soundlessly. From the common room, he entered the corridor. It was a wooden floor in the common room, but in the corridor there were lino tiles, geometries in bright colours. You had to be careful not to get lost on it, not to try stepping only from green square to green square, or find yourself marooned on a red triangle. The tiles were new and part of a scheme to brighten things up. The administrator had visited them. He had addressed them in the chapel after Sunday service, spoken from the black wood of the pulpit. Time for a change, ladies and gentlemen. We are entering the age of opportunity.
Now, it is set in the early 60s, but the tagline is,
where do you hide when you can't leave home? Was that inspired by an event perhaps a bit closer to us in time?
I mean, you know what? It didn't actually occur to me right at the beginning that there was this sort of connection. But of course, when somebody pointed it out to me, it was very obvious. And yes, it became very difficult to move around. The schools were shut and so on. So there were lots of things going on then that we became kind of familiar with during the pandemic. Lots of sort of sudden shortages in the shops. We all remember sort of some of the rather curious shortages that we experienced around the time of the pandemic. And just the sense of being a sense of dislocation, a sense of the normal having been rather abruptly brought to an end. That certainly would have been a part of it. I mean, this was a wartime generation, of course, though, in 1962. These were people who, in a sense, I think, had a kind of preparation for something of this kind. And I think they generally responded to it pretty well. They were used to toughing it out. You know, and also, in a sense, we were saved by various things like the railways, which pre-beaching was still going to lots of sort of towns and villages that now they no longer go to. And they were sort of dug out by gangs of bizarrely kind of patient and tolerant and long-suffering men in cloth caps who sort of lived on cigarettes and bacon sandwiches and cups of tea. So it was, but you're right, there's a very definite parallel with COVID, which I say didn't really occur to me right at the beginning, and what it did was sort of blindingly obvious.
You mentioned the war, and that's a motif in a few of your books, because the echoes go on far longer after the guns have stopped.
Well, that's right. I mean, they do. I mean, I think in Britain, the war wasn't really over till sort of, I don't know, the mid-1970s in some way. Or, you know, I think punk rock was the end of the war. And it's so far as when we, you know, growing up, my generation, certainly, you know, all the films, the comics, all the stories, you know, that our parents told us, you know, just little anecdotes of, you know, day-to-day life in the war. And, you know, it was around finishing your food, because, you know, there's a great sort of awareness of sort of the paucity of things and how necessary it was to everything should be used and used properly. So, yeah, I want to, and it's, you know, 17 years, the book begins 17 years after the end of the Second World War. And of course, these are people, the characters in the novel, they were all sort of teenagers through the war, not quite old enough to have taken an active part in the war. So they, but, you know, it was 5 years of their growing up shaped by this experience. And yeah, I wanted it to sort of, you know, in a sense, they're caught between looking forwards to a time where all kinds of new possibilities for living will emerge and are beginning to just be sensed, you know, the possibilities of living a different life, but also constantly glancing back over their shoulders at the world of Britain at war, of the world at war, and also some of the things that have come out since then in terms of what people had learnt about what had happened.
The Land in Winter, available in all formats, ebook, audio and print commercially, and also available in audio and braille from RNIB. And Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Audition by Katie Kitamura is described as an exhilarating, destabilising novel that asks whether we ever really know the people we love. The audio version of Audition is read by Tracy Kato Kiriyama.
It seemed an unlikely choice, this large establishment in the financial district. So then I stood outside and checked the address, the name of the restaurant. I wondered if I had made a mistake. But then I saw him through the window, seated at a table toward the back of the dining room. I stared through the layers of glass and reflection, the frame of my own face. Something uncoiled in my stomach, slow and languorous, and I decided it would be better if I left now and did not go into him. At that moment, the front door opened and a man stepped out. He inclined his head and held the door open, and because of that small courtesy, an invitation or injunction to enter, I went inside. The foyer was busy with diners collecting their coats, people surging in and then out of the entryway, and briefly I allowed myself to be buffeted by their movement. When the crowd dispersed, I could see across the dining room floor again. He was bent over the menu, examining it in a nervous posture. His table was between the entrance to the kitchen and the bathrooms, caught in a stream of constant traffic. A pair of businessmen bumped against its edge, and he sat back impatiently. I saw him take a deep breath, as if trying to collect or steady his thoughts.
Audition is about a woman who is very much in the middle of her life. She's an actress. She is happily married. And her life is upended when a stranger comes to her and tells her that he believes he is her son.
And I believe it was a headline that gave you the idea for the book.
It was. I saw a headline that read, "A stranger told me he was my son." And I actually didn't click on the link because even just from those handful of words, I already knew that there was a novel in that premise for me somewhere. But I couldn't quite work my way beyond the premise and into the actual world of the novel. And so for quite a long time, I set the idea aside and I wrote another book. Then I was going for a walk with a friend who's a poet and whose son is quite a bit older than my own children, who's now in his mid-20s. And I recited the headline to her and she just looked at me and said, "But that's just a description of parenthood. Every time my son comes home from university, it's like a stranger has walked into the apartment." And at that moment, I really had a sense of the book that I wanted to write, which is about the contradictions and the incommensurability that's very much at the heart of some of our most universal experiences, whether those are of parenthood or of marriage or of making art.
It's not just older children. I think from baby to toddler, they become a different person almost every couple of weeks. There's always something new.
I think that's very true. You know, before I had children, I think I wrote quite a lot about the instability within interpersonal relationships in the context of marriage or, you know, romantic relationships. And I was very preoccupied with this moment when you look at a person who you think you know very, very well, and then they appear to you like a stranger. And then, of course, once I had children, I realized that that is extraordinarily turbocharged with children. As you said, they are changing rapidly, even between the ages of kind of birth and 5, 6 years old. You know, there's the emergence of language, of personality. Their own sense of you also changes very profoundly. I think you become a different person for them. I remember the first time my children realized that my name wasn't actually Mommy, that I had a name out in the world, and that to the world I was somebody other than who I was to them. It's a really mutable and fascinating relationship.
The host asked if I had a reservation. I said that I was meeting someone and indicated the young man seated at the back of the restaurant, Xavier. It occurred to me that the host must have been the person to seat him at this inhospitable table, and I saw a flicker of surprise cross his features as I pointed. He looked quickly from my face to my coat to my jewelry. It was my age above all. That was the thing that confounded him. He gave a tight smile and asked me to please follow him. I was under no obligation to obey. I could tell the host that I had made a mistake or that something had come up. I could turn and slip away. But by that point, it seemed too late. And much as I had entered at the behest of the man at the door, according to the imperative of mere courtesy, I followed the host through the warren of tables, each one occupied. I wondered again why Xavier had chosen such a crowded venue at such a busy time, when we might just as easily have met elsewhere, in the afternoon, in the morning or early evening, for a coffee or quiet drink.
Let's talk about the structure of the book. There are two distinct halves that split almost bang on in the middle. How did you come up with that structure?
I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons why I use that structure. One is that I had the sense very much as a writer that I had not fully employed all the possibilities of structure in my work. And I was interested to see if structure could do some of the work that we conventionally associate with plot. So can structure create the sense of momentum that carries a reader through to the end of the book? Can structure create an effect that is not dissimilar to that of a plot twist, for example? Those are some of the things I think I was formally or theoretically interested in when I was thinking about the structure. But Really, I think it was the sense that I could either write about this sense of incommensurability, this sense that there are things that are irreconcilable in our lives, that we can be strangers both to others and to ourselves. I could either write about it or I could write it directly into the form of the book, and I opted for the latter.
Now, we won't go into spoiler territory, but there are problems with the book's memory. Is that a reflection of something about your character? I'm trying not to use the word dementia, but there is a sort of reality shift in the book. Was there the thought that the memory of the character isn't what it should be?
I love this phrase, reality shift. So one of the things I really wanted to do in this book was to write something that was very open to interpretation. I wanted the book to be read in several different ways. And I would often describe it as a rabbit duck drawing of a book. So if you look at it from one angle, you see a rabbit. And if you look at it from another angle, you see a duck. And in the middle of the book is a story about an actor who has dementia. And while he is beginning to lose his memory, he turns in a performance that is really very, very extraordinary. And the central character, the narrator, is very moved by this performance. And then she is told that, in fact, the actor has dementia. And she's trying to understand if that changes the nature of the performance. And I think ultimately she decides that the performance itself exists, and that performance exists between in the space between the actor and the viewer, in the kind of space of interpretation that's really made by the viewer as much as it is made by the intentions of the actor. And I think I wanted that to be a little bit of a guide to how I was thinking about writing the book, which is that to some extent, I think my intentions felt, I wanted to separate the text a little bit from what my own intentions as an author were. I don't think I have any more authority over the text than, say, the reader does. But what I will say is that when I was getting the kind of first set of impressions back from various people at my publisher, quite a few people felt that the central character had dementia in some form or another. And that was the reason for, as you described, this reality shift. And that is certainly one of the intended ways for the novel to be read.
Do you know the book by Ali Smith called How to Be Both?
I know of the book and I have not read the book, which is terrible. I'm a big fan of Ali Smith. I don't know how it is that I haven't read that one.
How to Be Both is two stories that talk to each other, but the book was published in such a way that half the copies had one story at the beginning and half the copies had the other story at the beginning. So the reader never knew in what order they were going to get the stories. Is that sort of like audition where we could read the second half first and then consume the first half?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I was talking to a wonderful writer, Caleb Azuma Nelson, who said that he read the novel through as it is printed. And then the second time he read the novel through, he started at the beginning of the second half and then read the first half as the second half. I really wanted to write a book that felt like a circle, that it could loop back to the front of itself in some way, like a Möbius strip in a way. There's also a wonderful book that was published this year by the American writer Catherine Lacey, which sounds not dissimilar structurally to the Ali Smith novel in terms of how it was produced, because if you could start on either side of the book, it's kind of on one side, it flips over. I'm not explaining it very well, but it's upside down. So you can read either half as, it's really impossible to tell which is the actual front of the book. And it produces a similar effect where you're not quite sure where the beginning is and which half is the start. I mean, I think mine probably has a more concrete beginning, middle, and end, but I really like the idea that you wouldn't be able to prioritize which half of the book was the so-called reality and which half of the book was a maybe fantasy world or a construction.
Audition is available in print, in audio, and as an ebook commercially. It's also available in Braille and audio from RNIB Talking Books. Anki, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny by Kieran Desai is described as a spellbinding story of two young people who whose fates intersect and diverge across continents and years. An epic of love and family, India and America, tradition and modernity. The audio version is read by Sneha Mathan.
The sun was still submerged in the wintry murk of dawn when Ba, Dadaji, and their daughter Meena Foy, wrapping shawls closely about themselves, emerged upon the veranda to sip their tea and decide, through vigorous process of elimination, their meals for the rest of the day. Orders must be given to the cook at breakfast so that he could go directly to market. It was Meena's 55th birthday, the 1st of December in the year 1996, and the mutton for the dinner kebabs had been marinating overnight in the kitchen.
"Rice?" Ba shouted. "Roti?"
She was growing deaf, but she knew she must raise her voice over the morning traffic thundering past the front gate and the cawing of hundreds of crows, their racket and the sun struggle so closely linked, it was as if each morning the crows gave birth to the light.
"Palau?"
she suggested. "Paratha?" Perched above them, at the entrance portico, sat a plaster bust of a portly gentleman in a cravat, perhaps inspired by a drawing made by the bungalow's original owner, who had toured Europe, sketchbook in hand, in the same manner he'd observed foreigners doing in India. And perhaps it was the fault of the artist's rendering, or the dissonant surroundings of Allahabad, or a splattering of bird droppings, but the bust resembled less a dignified nobleman than a foolish snob with an interest in the sky overhead, which had not turned vivid for a quarter of a century.
"So this is a book I've been working on for well over a decade, and it is centered on the long unresolved love story of Sonia and Sunny. But it also includes all the other stories, all the other love stories or lack of love stories around them, the stories of their parents and grandparents and friends. And it's also a book about how all those other stories affect the story of Sonia and Sunny."
Unperturbed by the fancy gentleman or the polluting lorries or the family upon the veranda, the crow's caw caw rose to crescendo.
"Cauliflower?"
Ba urged.
"Spinach?"
"Potato?" Dadaji said, lifting his feet off the ground. He rubbed them together as lovingly and extravagantly as if they were soft velvet hands. "The Gujarati loves a potato more than most," he said, as if explaining themselves to an absent anthropologist.
Was it always going to be a love story, or did their relationship develop through the writing?
I wanted to write a love story out in the globalized world, you know, but it was also equally to be a story about loneliness. At first, romantic loneliness, but then later I realized that I could extend the scope of that idea and write about loneliness in many different forms and talk about all the divides in our globalized world as a kind of loneliness. The divides between nations, classes, races, you know, a sort of forlornness.
Is there such a thing as cultural loneliness?
Yes, I think Sunny and Sonia are both, you know, they both leave India for the United States. And so there's that feeling of dislocation or displacement, but they're also, you know, creating sort of unknowable creatures out of each other, out of themselves, unknowable creatures out of themselves. So there's a sort of deeper process, not just being, not just a feeling of being lonely out in the big world, but a much more an existential loneliness.
This is both a quote and a question, but does a writer have to be lonely?
I think yes. I think a writer has to be lonely in order to spend so many hours and days and months and years at a desk working in a very solitary way. So one of the lonelinesses I wanted to write about, in fact, was, you know, exquisite artistic loneliness. of the extreme happiness of working when there are no eyes on you at all. So that heaven of being completely unself-conscious.
Yes, yeah, Stephen King calls that writing with the door closed.
Really. But you know, it was interesting. I was just traveling for my book and I went to William Faulkner's house when I was in Oxford, Mississippi. And there's a little plaque out there in the front of the house which said, where he says he was never lonely because he was living with all of his characters. So, you know, that rings true as well. I was living for years with Sonia and Sonny and their families.
Now, talking of travel, the book is in America and in India, but it also goes to Italy and to Mexico. Did you travel to these places by way of research?
Yes. You know, the door opened to Mexico very naturally because I live in a very immigrant community in New York City. And it is Asian and Hispanic, primarily Hispanic. So the language around me is Spanish. And Sunny in my novel, you know, is intrigued by this mix of people and he goes across the border to Mexico. And it was my experience of traveling to Mexico that when I was there, I understood the United States much better than I ever could living within the United States. Mexico holds such a mirror up to the United States. And so Sunny, so yes, I, as well as my character Sunny, both went to Mexico and I lived in the little village described in my book while I was writing those passages. The same for Italy. I was invited to writer's residencies there and that's how I came to write the chapters on Venice.
Now, talking of holding a mirror up, Sonia is an Indian author living and writing in America. Were you holding a mirror up to yourself?
Yes, I was. I think many of her thoughts and ideas about writing and dilemmas really are my dilemmas. And this is very much a portrait of a young, you know, a portrait of a young woman and a portrait of an artist as a young woman. And so she is thinking very much about a story, stories, Indian stories out in the big world and how they will be read. And I think that is something that is true of authors like myself. You know, I was just talking about the heaven of being, of not being self-conscious while you're writing. But if you are an Indian author who's published abroad, you do tend to see yourself from outside in, not only from inside out. You're always aware that a book from our part of the world will be, the story will be considered in a political way, that, you know, your work is not entirely going to be read as a novel. It'll also be seen as a representation of India.
Do you see your readers as Indian or as international?
Completely international. So, you know, when I'm often asked in an audience, who are you writing for? Who is your reader? Do you think about a reader? And I think in today's world, you just cannot think of a reader because the readership is international. I do think that this book is, I think, in the diaspora, Indian diaspora, is particularly interested in this book. But no, I think it is being read by all manner of people, which is lovely.
The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny by Kiran Desai, narrated by Sneha Mathan, is available in audio, in print, as an ebook commercially, and in audio and braille from RNIB. And Kiran, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Such an honour speaking with you.
The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz is described as an unforgettable road trip of a novel about a middle-aged academic whose marriage, career and body are failing him. The audio version of the book is read by Eric Myers.
When our son was 12 years old, my wife had an affair with a guy called Zach Zersky, whom she knew from synagogue. He was a little younger, 3 or 4 years, had 3 boys, all younger than our 2 kids, but was in some sense in the same position as my wife. They both had partners who made good money, which meant they didn't have to do much and got bored and restless and maybe even depressed. Zach's wife was head of oncology at Westchester County. I saw Zach touch Amy's hand under the fold-out table at the Purim food bank drive, under the paper cloth. He was short, about 5'8", broad-shouldered and dark. He wore linen shirts open at the chest. His chest hair had started going gray. On Sundays, he played guitar for the kids at Temple Beth and taught them Jewish songs like Spin, Spin, Sevivon, very pro-Israel, in a tree-planting, happy-clappy way. He was the kind of guy who danced with all the old ladies and little pigtailed girls at a bar mitzvah, so he could also put his arm around the pretty mothers and nobody would complain. Even before I saw them holding hands, I didn't like him.
It's a book about what happens to a marriage once the kids leave home and the couple have to find a new shape to their lives.
The main protagonist, he'd sort of made a deal with himself about 12 years ago.
Yes, yeah, that's right. So it starts off with the narrator, whose name is Tom. His wife had an affair when the kids were small. And he makes a deal with himself that when the youngest leaves home, he can walk out on the marriage. And the novel opens when he drops his daughter at university. And instead of driving home again, he keeps going across America.
My parents are Catholic, but my dad thought religion was just a big fancy dress party. And he hated fancy dress. Maybe this is why I never got involved in the synagogue, which meant Amy had a whole social network where she had an identity, and I didn't. She told me about Zach after I already knew, and after it was already over. Amy had highly developed guilt feelings, which were so strong she couldn't help being mad at whoever she felt guilty toward, which was often me. She said she wanted to make me mad, too. She just wanted some kind of reaction. That's all she was looking for. But that's not really my style. If there's something you can do to fix something, I try to do it. But in this case, I wasn't sure what. She said, "You don't feel anything about anything." I said, "Everything I do for you and the kids. Nothing else matters to me." "So what do you want to do?" I asked her. "Do you want a divorce?" But she didn't want that. At least, not until the kids had left home. The home and the kids were all she had to show for the last 12 years of her life. The thing with Zach didn't mean anything. It was more like a kind of self-harm. She knew that I knew that when she was a teenager, she used to cut herself on the thigh. A bid for attention. But Amy's a person who tells stories about her motives and actions, which are very persuasive to her as well. So it's sometimes hard to talk about or even work out what's really going on.
And it's not really a deliberate, he doesn't bash his fist on the table and say, "I'm going on a road trip." He just sort of meanders away.
Yeah, that's right. And I almost hesitate to say that he made this deal with himself because it was a long time ago. It's not like he'd been planning it the whole way through. In fact, his wife was supposed to come along on the drive where they dropped off his daughter. It's just something that kind of builds, a kind of pressure in his life has been growing and growing. And so instead of turning home again after he says goodbye to his daughter, who he was very close to, he decides to set off in another direction. And he ends up seeing various people from his old life, his brother, an ex-girlfriend, a college buddy, and eventually his son in California. That's why he keeps driving to California.
What was the initial seed? Did you want to write a road trip novel or did you want to look at a couple's marriage?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't always remember. I'm not a completely reliable witness. I just sat down and wrote the opening page. I don't know why it occurred to me or what I was doing when it occurred to me, but I came back to it a few months later and I thought there were some interesting things there. Thought it was interesting that it wasn't the man who'd had the affair, that he felt he'd done nothing wrong and that was going to be part of the story, that he has to realize that maybe feeling like you've done nothing wrong is part of the problem. And the road trip sort of grew out of the conceit, which is that he drops his daughter off at university. I think on some level, we all love a road trip. Like a lot of us love a road trip. And it was a way of making a story about the breakdown of a marriage have an element of adventure to it so that it wasn't all heavy.
Now, you mentioned you're not a reliable witness. So how reliable a narrator is Tom?
What did you think?
I think he's, to put it in a Scottish way, he's kidding himself on. Plus, he's being like all men and ignoring symptoms that he really should get looked at as well. He should have more action. You know, he's been very passive, especially with his own health.
I guess so. I mean, it's funny you say he's been passive because he does start off by driving across America and leaving his marriage behind, which seems like a fairly active thing to do. Yeah, I actually was never a fan of the phrase unreliable narrator, because most narrators are reliable in one way or another. You just might not agree with them. And I guess I would say about Tom that it's not that he's unreliable in any shifty or deceptive sense. It's just that he has a view of what's going on that the reader might not necessarily share. It doesn't mean he's wrong, but it seems to me one of the things I could explore in the novel was the limit of his worldview.
Yeah, his worldview does seem to be, well, he sees the world in grades. He grades everything.
Yes.
He tells himself he's got a C minus marriage.
Yeah, I thought that was the last line of the opening section that I'd written. And I like moments in a character's life where what they think seems both on the one hand kind of reasonable, but on the other totally crazy. So what he says is that if you have a wife who'd had an affair, if you have a C minus marriage is what he says, it's hard to score much higher than a B on the rest of your life. And I can see why he would say that, but it seems like obviously the wrong way of looking at your life and your marriage. He has reasons for viewing his life through the lens of grades. He was an academic striver. He's a professor. He's worked very hard to get into his position so that it comes naturally to him to think of life in terms of measurable achievement. But it's also getting him down, and he has to learn of a new way of thinking about his life.
The Rest of Our Lives by Benjamin Markowitz is available in print as an ebook and audio commercially. It's also available in audio and braille from RNIB. And Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for our whirlwind tour of all six authors on the Booker shortlist. Those were six short edits. We'll have the winner on next Friday's show, and we'll examine all the books in future editions of Read On. All the books are in the RNIB library in both audio and braille. To join, call 0303 123 9999, or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.